Okay, welcome everybody. This is the second lecture of the Mises Academy Econ 730 class, Keynes, Krugman, and the Crisis. And I am broadcasting right now from sunny Florida down at my parents' house, so that's why the background's different and I'm not in my standard attire. Also, I have some kind of cold or something, so that's why I'm going to be going through cough drops as we go through this, so my apologies for that. Let me just make a few general housekeeping remarks before we jump into tonight's lecture. I am still struggling with what to actually assign you guys for week three's reading. I think what I'm going to end up doing is making it the mandatory part that everyone needs to do, keep that on the light side. I think it's just going to be the last chapter of the general theory. So of course, I'm going to send this all out in an email once I post your quiz for week two. I'll send it all in one email so I'm not cluttering your inbox, but I'm just telling you guys now who happen to be hearing this live. So it'll be the last chapter for sure, and then I'm just looking through right now to see what sections can I assign as optional readings from the last few chapters of the book, because it's the problem is, the reason I'm struggling with this is it's hard for me to, if you were going to read 200 pages from the general theory, then it would be fine. I could show you which 200 pages to read so that you'd have a really good grasp of what Keynes is getting at and you could understand where he's coming from. But I think that's too much reading to assign for just a few weeks. So I don't want to overload people. I think if I go on, I want to shoot for assigning something that's realistic so that more of you do it. So I'm going to keep the mandatory reading for week three on the light side to give you time to catch up in case you fell behind on week two, because I still think the stuff I assigned, chapters 1, 2, and 3, and then the small excerpts from chapter 12, that's actually pretty good, about 50 pages. If you just read that, I think you would really get what Keynes is doing without all of the technicalities. But as far as understanding his proposals, he talks a lot about interest rates and investment and marginal efficiency of capital, and that's what I'm struggling with. I don't think there's a way I can give you 40 pages to summarize that. I had to do it all. So what I'm going to do is, for everybody, keep it on the lighter side and not get into the technicalities of it. But then, for those of you who really want to dive into it and start talking about his equations and things, we can do that in the forums, right? So like for questions for the professor for week, what will that be? Three. By all means, if you want to get into, hey, he says this on this particular page, and I think that's wrong, or what does he mean by that, I'm certainly happy to walk through it with you guys. But we've got like 150 people in this class, and I don't think everybody wants to start talking about derivatives and things of the production function. So that's why I'm doing it this way. I think that's the only main thing that I wanted to make sure I discussed. So again, that will go out officially and will be posted within the next 24 hours as to what you need to read for week three. I'm just explaining to you guys why it's tricky. I'm still trying to decide. The other thing, too, is I have added a few things in case you haven't checked the syllabus in a while. There are a few things in particular. Paul Krugman's talk about Keynes, we added that just as an optional thing. So if you want to look at that, go ahead. And what does it mean when we say optional? Just to be clear, it means I will never quiz you or test you in the final on something that you would only know if you just watched that Krugman video. That's what we mean when I say something is mandatory or optional, that is a fair game for me to test you on. Okay, so let's jump into tonight's material because we've got a lot to cover. So, first of all, Roman numeral one, a Hitler gotcha. Here, what I'm getting at is in the preface to the German edition, there's this passage where Keynes says, I'll read it out loud for those of you who are just hearing the audio. So Keynes is talking to the German audience, trying to explain the relationship of the general theory to them, and he's saying in this one part, nevertheless, the theory of output as a whole, which is what the following book purports to provide, referring to the general theory, is much more easily adapted to the conditions of a totalitarian state than is the theory of the production and distribution of a given output produced under conditions of free competition in a large measure of laissez-faire. All right, so it's if you go and look at the context of that, it's really hard to say exactly what does he mean by that. That it's obviously people who are out to get Keynes point at that and say, see, the guy's a totalitarian, he's a central planner. And that's actually, this came up, for those of you who are aware of it, in the second Hayek versus Keynes video that Russ Roberts and John Papola, or Papola, I don't know how you say his last name, put out. That was a thing that, I mean, they did it partly just for the rhyme, that at one part Hayek says something like, I want to let individuals do their things, not your central plan, something like that. And so a lot of people got huffy, a lot of Keynesians got huffy saying, oh my gosh, they accused Keynes of being a central planner, but no, he wasn't. He was a classical liberal. And so this is one of the things that the people who were defending that video came out with and said, what are you talking about? Keynes right here quite clearly said that his worldview is best implemented by a totalitarian state, and he said it to the Germans in 1936, so you do the math. And the defenders would say, no, that doesn't mean anything. He's just saying that, you know, he's not saying that he wants there to be a totalitarian state. He's just saying the fact is that the sorts of things that are discussed in my book are more easily illustrated in the totalitarian state. So anyway, like I said, just you can look at it yourself. I'm just here pointing it out and explaining to you why this is important, and so since we're covering a general theory, I just wanted to bring this to your attention. But you can, like I said, even myself looking at the context, it's not obvious to me what exactly is he saying. When you say it's much more easily adapted to, does he mean that if you're going to have a theory of output, it's possible that what Keynes is saying is just this, is to say to the Germans, since your system is so different from the conditions of the economic system that prevailed in 19th century Great Britain, where the Ricardo and all those guys developed their economic theories, obviously you can't use their systems to explain your economy, but my general theory not only can explain why there's unemployment right now in the United States and in Great Britain, but also my general theory can be applied to your system too. So Keynes could have meant just something that innocuous, that my theory can explain anything, either, you know, a free market society, a classical liberal society like the one that I personally would endorse, or your nut job society where you've got a dictator walking around, because my theory is a general theory. All right, so it's possible that he means just that. Or, you know, he could mean something more sinister. Okay, so let's move on. The general theory, and so here I'm putting in italics the word general. And so let's make sure you don't miss this big point as to why does he call it the general theory of employment, interest, and money. What he's doing there is in the same sense in which Einstein's special relativity was a generalization of classical mechanics. All right, so in case you guys don't know this and you're missing the analogy, when Einstein came along and in a sense overturned classical physics, specifically what's called mechanics, that Isaac Newton was the father of, the way he did it, it wasn't so much that he said, no, those guys are just totally wrong, because that would have been a little bit odd, because you'd say, well, no, but Newton's equations seem to work fairly well, at least in certain settings and so forth, so it's not that he was just wrong, and plus he wasn't a really smart guy, and we had this tradition, so the way that the special relativity revolution, if you will, worked is it said, oh no, if things are traveling at low velocity, then Einstein's equations of special relativity reduced to Newtonian mechanics. All right, so it showed that Newton wasn't wrong so much, it's just he was focusing on a special case when things weren't traveling close to the speed of light. But in general, Newton's laws were simply wrong. You know, he thought he was describing the laws of nature, and he was wrong. He was writing down stuff that wasn't true, but it's that it wasn't true in general. It was approximately correct when things were not moving close to the speed of light. And so that's what the tack that Keynes is taking here is he's saying, I'm not saying that Adam Smith and David Ricardo and all those guys were idiots and just totally wrong. What I'm saying is that their system only works, it's only true if we're at full employment. And when we are at full employment, everything they say is perfectly correct. And their policy prescriptions are also correct when we're at full employment. But in general, we may not be at full employment. And so then in general, what they say is wrong and in fact could be disastrous. And Keynes, of course, thinks that that's what was going on in the 30s. All right, so this is also the rhetorical angle that Paul Krugman takes, as we'll see later on. That he says that the stuff that the free market guys are talking about, the things like if the government borrows more and runs a big deficit and spends, that pushes up interest rates and that crowds out private investment. And so every dollar the government spends is a dollar less for private investment. Krugman says that's true if we're already at full employment. But if we're not at full employment, then it's not true. Okay, so just make sure you get this aspect, and that's why he uses the word general. I see someone, Danny, saying in the comments, interesting that Keynes wrote about Newton too. Are you in Newton? Okay, I want to make sure that, so you're contributing that, you're not basing it off of, I was just saying that's the analogy. I don't know that Keynes wrote about that stuff, but if you're saying he did, then he did. I'm not contradicting you. Okay. So the general theory, okay, I'm just restating what I said there. So the classicals were right in the special case of full employment. Okay, now, let's just be clear, because this, again, is something that when people argue about Keynes and the general theory, this is one of the points of contention. When Keynes is going through here, referring to the classical economists or what are the teachings or the postulates of classical economics, there's a bit of a confusion. And so people who are critics of Keynes get a little huffy and say that this is a straw man and this isn't fair. So let me just explain to you what the concern is. So here on the top row, I've listed pictures of people that I think most economists would say, if you just ask somebody, you didn't give them context, you didn't say that you were talking about John Maynard Keynes, you just grabbed some random PhD economists and said, hey, who were the classical economists? I think what they would be, so here, let me skip ahead in the slide, and I'll come back to those pictures. So I'm looking at the slide A, what most mean by the classicals. I think most people have in mind the economists before the marginal revolution, which remember happened in the early 1870s. So the marginal subjectivist revolution is typically dated in the early 1870s when Karl Menger, William Stanley Jevons, and Leon Walras came out with their independent discoveries of the principle of marginal utility and how that can be used to explain pricing. So before then, that's kind of like the dividing line. So before then, that was the classical economists, and they generally adhered to a cost or a labor theory of value. And then after those guys in the 1870s was when what we now know of as modern subjective value theory really rose to the ascendancy. Okay, so guys like Adam Smith, David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, and the great French economists like Jean-Baptiste Say and Frederick Bastiat, those guys are what I think most economists now have in mind if you said to them, who are the classical economists? So going back to these pictures, that's who these guys, I think that's Adam Smith, Ricardo Say, and John Stuart Mill are the people on that top row. And then the bottom row is, I think that's Marshall, who's that? Is that Pigou? And then, of course, Mises and Lionel Robbins, because those are the people that Keynes has in mind. So now I'm looking at slide B. In terms of the discussion of the book, you know, when Keynes is talking about the classical school and so forth, it sure seems like what he means is just orthodox economists of his day, the free market fuddy-duddies who think, no, there's no role for government intervention. I mean, that's the people who think markets clear, just don't mess with markets, prices and wages will adjust. And in particular, they adopt the lessons of what we now call Say's Law. And in particular, Keynes is saying these people, they took it as a given that there was a certain amount of output in the economy, and then they came up with principles or laws discussing how that output gets distributed to various classes. So that was one of the things that Ricardo was really interested in, was how is the national output or national income divvied up to the workers, to the landowners, and so forth. So, but like I say, in terms of the rhetoric, Keynes is clearly attacking even the people of his day who are teaching this standard economic view, saying that if the government runs a deficit, that's just less stuff available for the private sector. So why would that stimulate total output? You know, the government can't create more output, or there can't be a general glut because, as J.B. Say taught us, whatever is produced, that provides the market with which other people can then sell their own wares, or for which people can sell their own wares. And so you don't need to worry about there being enough aggregate demand. That takes care of itself. Okay, so now a geeky little side note. Keynes in Chapter 1 in a footnote does address this issue, the fact that what he's using the term classical in a perhaps unusual way. And what Keynes says there is that Karl Marx used the term classical to mean Ricardo and before, and Keynes said he's using it to mean the successors of Ricardo, including John Stuart Mill. And so I'm just pointing out here in this little slide, just be careful. It's not a big deal. You don't need to worry about it. But technically, the distinction I just made for you guys 2 minutes ago would have John Stuart Mill being counted as a classical economist in the old school tradition, and Keynes is saying that's not what Karl Marx would have said. So anyway, it's not too big of a deal, but I didn't want you to get confused in case you read Keynes' footnote and that didn't quite mesh with what I just taught you. And I'm just saying it's because Keynes is using Karl Marx's view of where the dividing line is between the classicals and the post-classicals, and I'm saying I don't think that's what modern economists, I don't think they would put it at Ricardo. I think they would put it at in the 1870s. But anyway, not a huge deal. What is important is, for sure, wherever we put that dividing line, Keynes is including people like Alfred Marshall and Pigou, and that's who Keynes has in mind when he's attacking what he calls classical economics. And for sure, most other economists would say, no, Alfred Marshall is almost like, by definition, a neoclassical economist. If you go and look up neoclassical economics, I mean, I haven't done this, but it's possible if you go look up neoclassical economics on Wikipedia, it might say it started with Alfred Marshall. That was partly what his deal was, is Alfred Marshall was trying to take the insights of the subjective revolution in terms of value theory and then marry it to all of the wisdom that the classical economists had built up in terms of the production of wealth and free trade and all that stuff and the distribution of income. So Alfred Marshall certainly saw himself as a neoclassical economist. And so it's just a bit weird if Keynes is calling him a classical. So, and again, the reason it's not just an arbitrary thing about, oh, okay, well, one guy puts the boundary here, another guy puts the boundary here, who cares? It helps Keynes rhetorically. If he can say the people I'm attacking are the classicals, because then it looks like Keynes' theory is the newfangled modern cutting-edge one, whereas the older guys are very quaint. All right, so that's partly why the dispute comes up, is people are saying Keynes is going out of his way to make his opponents look bad by calling them classicals, when that's not the standard definition. Okay, so what are the postulates of classical economics? Now, for the rest of this lecture and in the PowerPoint, I'm not going to keep putting quotation marks around the word classical. So just keep in mind, from this point onward, I'm trying to distill what Keynes is talking about. So I'm sort of getting inside his head and telling you stuff from the perspective of John Maynard Keynes in the general theory. So I'm not going to keep stopping and saying classical with quotation marks, that you understand the context in which I'm saying this. Okay, so the first one He says that the wage equals the marginal product of labor. So employers keep hiring workers until on the margin, the extra net income, not counting the salary, from one more worker would be less than the wage. So this standard, this isn't controversial. Keynes agrees with this. All right, so there's no, we don't need to argue about it. The point is just, this is one of the postulates, okay? The fight's going to come on postulate too. So I just want to make sure you guys get what this postulate is, and then you realize that Keynes, you might have thought that Keynes was saying, I disagree with the classical economists, here's what they think about things, and so therefore, I disagree with all this. That's not what Keynes is saying. He's saying there's two primary postulates. The first is that the wage equals the marginal product of labor, and Keynes agrees. He said, yep, that's fine. Okay. Now, as a caveat with all this stuff, and Keynes says this in the general theory too, there are situations where the wage doesn't equal the marginal product of labor, like if there's monopoly or things like that, government-granted monopoly especially. But that's fine. Even the classical economists wouldn't have disagreed with that. Okay, so Keynes is saying, in the type of situation where you have open competition, blah, 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 it, where the wage would equal the marginal product of labor, the classicals all thought so, and I, John Maynard Keynes, agree with them. Okay. Now, where does the problem come in? The second assumption or postulate of classical economists, according to Keynes, is that the utility of the wage on the margin equals the disutility of labor. And so what does that mean in practice? It means that workers are going to keep supplying more units of labor until on the margin, the disutility of one more unit is higher than the declining utility of earning that additional money from more wages. Okay, so this is the thing that Keynes says is not true in general. And so he says, because the classical economists, which again included the economists of his day who are fuddy-duddy free market types, he's saying because they falsely believe this, they come up with horrible policy recommendations. They're just wrong when they diagnose what's wrong with the economy because they think this postulate has to be true, and it's clearly not true. And he's saying they just build themselves superstructures of absurdity because they are like they're committed to this view like it's a religious tenet, and so they come up with all this crazy stuff to try to explain what's right in front of their eyes, which is clearly the fact that this is false. Okay, so let me just take 2 minutes here to make sure you guys are comfortable with these postulates. So for now, forget about Keynes. Let's just think about why these two postulates are actually stuff that Austrians would endorse. Right, if Henry Hazlitt or Mises or somebody at Rothbard's talking to a general crowd about how the labor market works, they would probably say two versions of these two different postulates. So let me just walk you through in more comfortable language what this stuff is. All right, so the first one, so for people who just hear in the audio, I'm back on the wage equals the marginal product of labor. So there, I mean, that's pretty straightforward. That's just saying, what's the marginal product of labor? That's saying if you hire one more unit of labor, if you hire a worker, one more worker, or if you want to get real specific, say if you hire one more hour of labor, how much is your profit going to go up? Okay, so meaning, it's not just how much of your revenue is going up, because maybe you have to use more of other inputs too in order for that worker to work with, or maybe he uses your machinery and depreciates it, whatever. But the point is, all things considered, except for the wage, if you had another worker come and put in another hour, what does that do to your bottom line? So if that makes your profitability go up by $85, well, then you should be willing to pay up to $85 to hire that worker to come and work that extra hour or whatever it is. But if that's true and there's competition, then it can't be true that that guy's getting paid less than $85 for that hour of work. Because if you're only going to pay him $70, then there's scope there for some competitor to come along and to give him $71. And then you'd offer them 72 and so forth. So the only way, so in equilibrium, the claim is every productive factor is getting paid its marginal product. So for workers, their wage rate is equal to the marginal product of labor. Okay, so this is, you guys probably have your guard up reading anything in the general theory because you're afraid, even if it sounds reasonable and you agree with it, then Keynes is going to use it to prove, oh, there should be a big deficit. And so you're on your guard. So I'm saying this thing, you shouldn't be defensive about. This is just standard stuff. And Keynes agrees with it. Okay, the next one, the utility of the wage equaling the disutility of labor. Here, it's now we're looking at things from the worker's point of view. We're saying, and again, what I'm telling you is this postulate in slightly different words is something that's pretty standard in free market circles. As you're saying, from the worker's point of view, so we just talked about employers would be willing to keep hiring workers until the point at which the wage rate, that's another way of looking at it. For postulate one, let me do this and I'll come to postulate two. I just thought of an easier way to get across postulate one. Postulate one, saying the wage rate in equilibrium is equal to the marginal product of labor, one way to think about it is just assume the wage rate's fixed. Say the wage rate's $50 an hour, and then you ask employers, how many workers do you want to hire at that? They're going to keep hiring more and more workers, and each new worker they hire, that's going to push down the marginal product of labor. At some point, it's going to be diminishing, and they're just going to keep hiring more and more until the point at which, if we hired one more worker, that worker's marginal product would be less than $50 an hour, and so that's why we're not going to hire anymore. Okay, so that's what, from the employment side, the employer side, they're going to keep hiring workers until the marginal product gets pushed so low that it's equal to the wage rate, and they're not going to go any further. Now, postulate two, we're looking at it from the worker's point of view. Workers, whatever the wage rate is, they're going to keep working more and more hours, and every successive hour, every additional hour that a worker works, what happens? Well, he's getting more money, right, because he's getting the wage rate per hour. So the marginal utility of that money gets lower and lower because he keeps getting more and more money. On the other hand, his leisure time is shrinking the more he chooses to work. So on the margin, those leisure hours are getting more and more valuable to him as he has fewer of them. And so that's the flip side of saying the disutility of labor is getting higher and higher. So the point is, whatever the wage rate is, every worker then adjusts the amount of the quantity of labor he's willing to offer until the point that on the margin for him to offer one more unit of labor would involve him suffering disutility that was higher on the margin than the utility he gives to that extra wage payment he would get. Okay, so it's basically just saying, it's like if the price of apples is $1 a pound, consumers keep buying more and more apples until the margin utility of the next unit of that batch of apples is less than the utility they get from the remaining dollar. And the same thing with producers. They keep producing more and more apples until the point at which the marginal cost would be higher than the dollar that they would get from selling one more batch. Okay, so that's the same principle just applied to the labor markets. Okay, so Keynes is saying, though, that second postulate in general is wrong. Okay, so why is that the case? So Keynes versus the classicals here. Keynes points out that, look, if that second postulate is right, then there shouldn't ever be such a thing as involuntary unemployment. There can still be frictional unemployment. There can still be people in between jobs, and somebody could say, I'm out of work and looking. But the way we would classify that or interpret it is to say that person's really just searching and is being picky. You know, the person has job opportunities out there and could take jobs, but he's holding back trying to get something better, get a better offer. Okay, but there's clearly stuff there waiting to be seized. And so it's what we mean by involuntary unemployment. We'll define it formally in a few slides from now. I'll go over Keynes's formal definition of it. But just for our purposes right now, involuntary unemployment means you're a worker, you have the skills, you're perfectly willing to work at a job where for the market wage rate, you know, there are other people who have that job getting paid a certain amount, you would love to be in their shoes. So it's not that you want to get paid more than they're getting paid, you'd be willing to take their paycheck. And the other thing is, from the employer's point of view, your skill set is just as good as the people who happen to have jobs. So from the employer's point of view, he could get rid of one of the current workers and put you in the worker's place, and he'd be fine with that. So if that's true, and yet you still can't get a job, you go up to that employer and say, hey, I'd love to, I see you've got these guys working here, they have these skills, they're getting paid $10 an hour, I'd love to have this job for $10 an hour, what do you say? And the employer says, yeah, sorry, we've got as many guys as we want to hire right now. We're not looking to hire anymore, sorry. If that keeps happening to you everywhere you're going, then you're involuntarily unemployed. And so Keynes is saying, if the second postulate is true, there can be no such thing as involuntary unemployment. Everybody who is unemployed is doing so as a choice. And so this is, I'm trying to show you guys where the, if you're a free market person and you want to disagree with Keynes here, this is not where the argument is. Don't stop him here and say, no, this isn't fair. Mises in Human Action explicitly says, and I know this because we just taught it in the Rothbard Graduate Seminar and Walter Block got mad because he thought that Mises was going a bit too far in this passage. But Mises clearly says, in a free market, there can be no such thing as involuntary unemployment, that everybody who is unemployed in the free market does so as a free choice. It's just because he decides not to sell his labor for the going market wage. And he said, so, you know, if that's what somebody wants to do, fine, but we shouldn't be upset over the fate of the unemployed because they choose to be unemployed. Okay, so now, but Keynes doesn't stop there. He goes on to say, okay, the classical economists, they're not stupid. They can see with their own eyes full well, especially now in the 30s, there are millions of people who are out of work, and Keynes says something like, it's not that they became more truculent during the Depression, meaning it's not that they all raised their wage demands. You know, so what's going on here? And he's saying, Keynes says that what the classical economists do when they want to explain large-scale what seems to be institutional or systematic unemployment, it's not, you know, it's clearly not just, oh, people are quitting their job because they're moving to Albuquerque or something, that they sold their house and they need to get a different job, or they got married so they have to get a new job. That's not what's going on in the 30s. There is clearly something really screwed up with the labor markets. And Keynes is saying correctly, the way classical economists handle that, how do they reconcile that with their second postulate? He's saying, oh, it's because there must be something preventing wages from falling. That for some reason wages are being held above the market clearing rates, and so that's what's going on here. So that's not a market outcome. So whether it's due to labor unions and they're threatening violence is the way to enforce it, or whether it's because of government policy, the classical economists, and again classical in quotation marks because it's referred to economists of Keynes's day as well, would the only way they can salvage their theory, Keynes says, is to say, well, this large-scale unemployment is because wages must be artificially above the market clearing level. Because if we have a free market and wages can adjust, you know, the arguments we just went through, employers are going to keep hiring workers until on the margin they're at the wage equals the marginal product, and the workers are going to keep offering labor until on the margin the wage rate is just balancing the disutility of working one more hour. And so how can that be violated? The only way is if there's something institutional preventing wages from falling. Because think about, let me just make sure, this is a crucial point. Let me make sure you guys don't miss this. Let's look back at the second postulate. Why is it that, so for those listening, I flip back to the utility of the wage equals disutility of labor slide. Why is it that if this is true, you can't have involuntary unemployment? Because think about what that would mean. If there's involuntary unemployment, there's somebody who wants to work at the prevailing wage rate. So what does that mean? It means for that worker who's unemployed but would love to get a job, getting the same pay as the person who's got a job right now, for that person, the disutility of labor is lower than the utility of the prevailing wage rate. That's why the person really wants a job. He would be happy to exchange his leisure, at least on the margin, some of his leisure, for those first few units of the money he could get from a job. So for those involuntarily unemployed workers, this second condition is not true. And so that's, so the issue is, wait a minute, what's going on? And so the reason in a free market with flexible wages, the reason a classical economist would think this shouldn't last is they would say, well, wait a minute, if you've got thousands of people who are eager to work at the prevailing wage rate, but the employer says, no, at that prevailing wage rate, I've already hit the point where the workers are getting paid their marginal product, so I'm not going to hire any more workers. The classical economist said, well, then why don't you lower the wage rate? Lower the wage rate, you'll still be able to get some workers, right, because there was that gap. They weren't just indifferent. They were actively wanting to work at the prevailing wage rate, so some of them at least are still going to want to work if you lower the wage rate. And then if you lower the wage rate, you have more room to hire more workers. You have more of a gap there for the marginal product of labor to fall because the wage rate's lower. So if the wage rate goes down, the employer then is willing to hire more workers in line with that first postulate, and then the workers are still there waiting to be hired because the second postulate wasn't, hadn't kicked in yet if there was involuntary unemployment. Okay, so now you see how those two things fit together, and so that's why the classical economists, the so-called classical economists, are going to say, if there is widespread involuntary unemployment, since we believe in postulate two, the only explanation we have is that some force, like labor unions or the government, is preventing the wage rate from falling. Because in a free market, the wage rate would fall, so that condition one and condition two would both end up being true in equilibrium, and then anybody who's unemployed at that point would do so as a free choice. Okay, so now I'm flipping around here. So now I'm on slide C that says Keynes has two responses. So let me just stop. Time for another cough drop too. I'm going through this fairly slowly because this is crucial, and I want to make sure you guys understand the flow of the argument here. So that's why I'm going through this fairly slowly. So again, Keynes is saying there's those two postulates. For the classical economists, that second postulate that the utility of the wage equals the disutility of labor in equilibrium, that's inconsistent with involuntary unemployment. So the classical economist has no choice but to say, oh, well, if there is involuntary unemployment, which we can't deny that there is in the 1930s, clearly there's millions of people who want to work at the prevailing wage rate. So the classical economists say, well, there must be something keeping wage rates up, because otherwise our system doesn't work and we believe in our system dogmatically. Right? So this is Keynes' story, what's going on. And then Keynes now comes and says, aha, I have two separate objections or responses or criticisms of that move by the classical economists. So they're going to try to salvage their system. They're going to try to say that their second postulate is still valid by saying, workers must be insisting on wage rates that are too high. If we just had flexible wages, that would solve everything. So Keynes has two responses. So I'm partly stressing this because this is really important. There a lot of Keynesians, including Paul Krugman, get mad when they hear Chicago School of free market types claim that the Keynesians think the problem that can happen with markets is that wage rates are sticky. All right, I realize that was a convoluted sentence. Let me say that again, because this is explaining why I'm spending so much time on this. A lot of free market economists, and I used to do this too because I thought this was true, so this is something that I learned and realized I had to be more careful here. A lot of free market economists, in particular Chicago School guys who are big on monetary policy, they will try to explain Keynesianism by saying, oh, the Keynesians believe that in the real world, contrary to what the Chicago School believes, prices and wages aren't necessarily instantly flexible or can't instantaneously adjust. And so because, in particular, wages are sticky, especially that wages have a hard time going down, money wages, because of labor unions or whatever, just like psychology, workers don't like taking pay cuts. Because of that, that leads to involuntary unemployment because the market can't adjust. All right. So Krugman and other guys, and then Keynes himself here, are saying, no, 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 that's not what Keynes's central insight is. All right. So I just want to be clear on that. Keynes is not merely saying wage rates are sticky in the real world, therefore the free market doesn't work, we need deficit spending. He's saying something deeper than that. So that's partly why I'm stressing this stuff. And Krugman will say that a lot too. That Krugman, because here's what's happened. Let me just try to make sure you guys get the big picture. So the free market guys will say, well, duh, if the problem is even the Keynesians admit is that wages aren't flexible, then let's bash labor unions or let's tell workers to take a big pay cut. We don't need to have a deficit, you know, a huge deficit. Workers just need to stop being such crybabies and take a 10% pay cut, and then everything will be fine, even according to the Keynesians. And so the Krugman says, no, that's not true. You guys are idiots. That's not what the Keynesian system says. And in fact, Krugman says, even if all the workers did take a huge pay cut, that wouldn't solve the problem necessarily. Okay, so Krugman has said that, and I'm pointing out to you that he's not just making that up on the fly. That train of thought is right here in chapter, I think it's chapter 2 of the general theory. So that's what I'm going over here. Okay, so again, back to the PowerPoint show, now that I've just gone on a tangent to try to get you guys to see why I'm talking about it. Keynes has two separate responses to the claim that there's some institutional force keeping wage rates too high, and that that's what must be going on to prevent the labor market from clearing. Okay, so his first objection is empirical. And he says, the classicals are wrong for modeling workers as caring about real wages, meaning the classical school is sort of in line with J.B. Say's vision or description of the economy in terms of commodities trading against commodities. They tended to, and this is true, abstract away from money altogether, just viewing money as a veil and just saying, no, what workers really care about is how much stuff they can buy with their wages. So, for example, if there's general price deflation, a lot of free market economists, and I would say this too, so you know this isn't a straw man, would say no, it's okay if workers have to take a 10% pay cut, because if the price of everything at the store is going down by 10%, then workers will be fine with that. You know, the markets will still work, they'll still clear, we'll still get full employment, because workers will just need to see that no, prices are going down at the grocery store. And so as long as their paycheck is still able to buy as much stuff, the fact that, you know, if the money supply goes down or if we're on a gold standard and the population is growing and so prices in terms of gold get pushed down, somebody like Guido Holtzman is going to say that's not going to blow up the world economy. That, yeah, if prices in general are falling and maybe even some wage rates have to fall, no big deal. People will get into the new equilibrium, will change their expectations, and they'll come to expect falling prices. And so if prices are falling faster than their wages, workers will come to realize that they're getting paid more and more in real terms. So that's fine. They won't stop working just because, oh my gosh, my paycheck's going down by 2% every year. So that's how a modern Austrian would justify the gold standard to people who said, oh, what if there's not enough gold being produced? Won't that lead to deflation? You say, yeah, so what? Okay, so Keynes is saying, you guys are crazy. Open up your eyes, look around. That's simply not true. Workers do suffer from what economists call money illusion. That a worker would much rather have his money wages going up than have them go down. Even if the money wage went up, but prices in general went up more, that worker would probably be happier than if his paycheck went down, but the prices of everything at the store went down even more. In the first case, the worker would still think, I got a raise, even though that's silly. In the second case, he would still be moping, saying, oh, I got a pay cut, even though he actually now can buy more stuff. Okay, so Keynes is saying, just first of all, that's just wrong. Open your eyes. And so it's because of this stuff that those free market Chicago school guys thought, oh, Keynes is just saying that workers are stupid, they suffer from money illusion, and that's why Keynes thinks his policies, and in particular printing money, will help things, because that will raise prices to reduce the real wage, but workers are stupid, and they won't realize that their money, their wages is going less, or not going as far at the store, and so actually they're getting a pay cut. Okay, so it's a very subtle thing here. So it is true that Keynes does at times in the general theory say just that, that one of the benefits of just printing money and putting it into circulation is that will reduce the real wage that employers have to pay workers, because the prices of products are going up, but the money wages being paid to the workers doesn't need to go up, or doesn't need to go up as much. So effectively, the workers are all taking a pay cut, and for whatever reason, they are more willing to do that. If the problem is that workers if their wages are too high relative to everything else, Keynes would certainly agree a more practical way to solve that problem, rather than telling the workers to accept a nominal pay cut.
Good night, Daddy. Oh, I love you.
Good night. Okay. See you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. It's my son going to bed. Okay, so it's certainly true. I don't want to confuse you guys. If we say to John Maynard Keynes, hey, the problem is right now workers, their wages are too high compared to what the value of their output is, what do? We can either have the workers take an explicit nominal pay cut, reduce the amount of money they get per week in their paycheck, or we can run the printing press, try to raise the prices of everything that people have to buy, but not give the workers a pay raise. So in terms of purchasing power and the way the classical economists thought, those should be equivalent. They're both ways of reducing the real wage that workers get paid, and they're both ways to make it more profitable for the employer to hire workers. So those are two ways that should be equivalent to reducing unemployment, but Keynes would say, no, in the real world, going the inflationary route is going to work better, because just psychologically, for whatever reason, people would rather not get a pay cut, even if stuff at the stores get more expensive. Okay, so that's one thing. But now here is the trickier part that I want to highlight, make sure you don't miss. Keynes goes on and says, but beyond that, I have a more fundamental objection. And so I think this is still chapter two, where this stuff is coming from, in case you want to, after the lecture, go look it up for yourself. And you'll, now that I've outlined it, I would recommend you guys do read chapter one and two again, just to make sure it sinks in. You see how what I'm saying fits his words. So he says, okay, beyond that, the classical economists are wrong because they seem to think that the workers have it within their power to reduce their real wage. So the specific mechanism, of course, obviously in the real world, workers are getting paid in money. They're not getting paid in terms of tuna fish or cars or whatever it is that they're making. So it's not a barter economy. Everyone's getting paid in money. But the point is, Keynes says the classical economists are wrong because they think if the workers would just be willing to accept a pay cut in money terms, well, then they would also effectively be accepting a pay cut in real wages, which is what the classical system thinks workers actually care about. And so that should be curing the unemployment problem, right? So big picture, if we've got massive involuntary unemployment, how can that be? That should be impossible. What should happen is the wage should fall. But again, when we say the wage should fall, really in the classical school, we must mean the real wage, because that's what employers care about. When we say employers are going to pay people until the point at which the wage equals the marginal product, we're thinking in real terms, or if we're thinking in money, then it's the same money. And the same thing with workers. When we say the worker is going to work until the point at which the utility from the money wage is equal to the disutility of labor, the money wage there, I mean, we have in mind purchasing power of money. It's not enough to say, oh, a worker would be willing to work for $100,000 a year. Well, not if there's massive price inflation and then $100,000 a year can only buy you a loaf of bread, then somebody wouldn't be willing to, you know, do a certain job for a year just for $100,000. Get the $100,000 and only bought a loaf of bread. Okay, so the classical school, when they're talking about wages, they really mean real wages. So Keynes says that, and I'm endorsing that interpretation, that is true, that's ultimately the classical system has in mind real wages. So Keynes is saying the classicals are wrong because they think if there were institutional involuntary unemployment and there were no labor union barriers and no government barriers, well, that would just fix itself pretty soon because the workers who are unemployed should be willing to work for lower money wages than the people with jobs. And then competition would force everybody's money wages to go down. And now because prices are whatever they are, falling money wages means real wages are falling. And so now employers should be willing to hire more workers. So why doesn't that cure the problem? And Keynes is saying the problem with that argument is it doesn't work. He's saying, because think about it. So we've got a bunch of employers, right? And right now the employers are happy. There's a given money wage, and there's also a given level of prices of goods and services, right? And they're hiring they've hired a bunch of workers up until the point at which the last worker that I just hired, his marginal product was equal to the wage I just paid, so I'm not hiring any more workers. And yet there's millions of people out there who are unemployed who want to get a job. So Keynes is saying it's not obvious that if all those workers go to the bosses and say, hey, or all the unemployed people go to the boss and say, why don't you cut your wage rates 10% because I'll still work for that. And so the boss says, yeah, okay. So all the employers across the nation cut wages 10%, looking to hire more workers. But, oh, wait a minute. Now one of the major costs of production just went down by 10%. And so Keynes is saying, why wouldn't that then lead to competitive price wars on the product side? So before, the prices of whatever the products were in equilibrium, and they clearly had a lot to do with how much the wage rate was, the money wage rate of the labor that was used to make the product. So Keynes is saying, how could it possibly be that we can cut across the board systematically all the wage rates and that not lead to almost proportionate drops in the price of the final products? But if that's true, then workers haven't actually reduced their real wages. But yeah, they've accepted a cut in their money wages, but that was counterbalanced by a fall in the price of the final product. And so the real wage is basically back where it was before. And so if employers weren't willing to hire everybody who wanted to work at the previous real wage, they won't be willing to do it now either. Okay, so that's his argument. I think I'm going to do a Mises.org article on this. So just so you guys know, because there's a lot of material here, I don't have time to give you a full-blown critique. I just want to make sure at this point with this lecture tonight that I get across the basics of what Keynes is saying, and I'm pointing out where the dispute is so you sort of like know where to concentrate your firepower if that's the way you want to think of it. So I'm just saying I don't agree with him here. I have never understood this. Krugman, when he made this argument, I didn't understand either. It seems like they jump over that pretty quickly. Just for one thing, wage rates are not 100% of the cost of production. So even if it's true if wages are 80% of the cost of production, well, still, if you cut wage rates 10% and you assume that the price of the product is going to go down proportionately, it's not going to drop by the same amount. And so you're still going to get a drop in real wages, And so you're going to hire more workers. So you could just keep doing that over and over until you clear the labor market, it would seem to me. So even on its own terms, I don't think it works. And then beyond that, if you think through the logic of what employers would do or what firms would do and why do they undercut each other and so forth, I don't think that it follows. So in other words, it's not that firms want to lower their prices. If all of a sudden they're paying 10% less to their workers, the firms would rather keep prices as they are and just pocket that difference. The reason they would start lowering their prices is that they thought they could gain market share. Right? So I'm just saying, when you start thinking through the logic of it and doing it realistically and not just saying, oh, well, if their costs go down, their prices would go down too and move on, it's not clear to me that they wouldn't be willing to hire more workers. Because the only way you're going to increase your output is by hiring more workers. Okay, so let me just say that again. So here, just so you guys don't get too confused, I'm giving you very briefly Bob Murphy's response to John Maynard Keynes' second response to the classical economists when they're trying to explain why their second postulate is true in spite of large involuntary unemployment. So that's kind of a complicated thing, but I hope you guys are with me still. So my response to Keynes is, if workers did all accept a big drop in their money wages, yes, it's true that might. So for one thing, the labor component of the cost of production is not 100%. So even if prices did fall based on the percentage of the inputs that was due to labor, you would still get the fact that money wages fell by less than revenues fell. So real wages still would be falling. So workers would become cheaper to hire from the firm's point of view, so they'd be willing to hire more. So that should work. That should be a way to get rid of unemployment. But even beyond that, the mechanism through which a firm would lower its prices because its own cost of production fell, because, you know, Keynes is thinking, oh, we're in equilibrium. If it's a competitive market, a firm can't be earning above normal profits. So if one of their inputs gets cheaper, they ultimately pass that along to the consumer. That's what Keynes is thinking, and that's fine. That is true. But the mechanism by which that happens is a firm is going to increase its output. Right? It's not going to sell the same amount of widgets at a lower price. It's going to try to gain market share. Because now its prices are lower, it realizes I can afford to lower my prices, but by doing so, it's going to try to sell more, right? Because now the consumers aren't worse off, and so they're going to try to buy more. All right, so anyway, that's my response, but we're sort of now getting into the fifth and sixth levels of the argument. So I may try to write something up about that. Okay. Now I'm looking at slide D called Parsing Keynes, for those who are following after the fact and want to know where I am in the PowerPoint. So here I'm going to just read when Keynes defines involuntary unemployment, he has in this passage. So I just want to read this and then just make sure you guys see how all this stuff fits in with the two postulates and so forth. So I'm just sort of tying it all together to make sure you guys are with Keynes here and you get the big picture. So he says at one point, men are involuntarily unemployed if a small rise in the price of wage goods relatively to the money wage leads to an increase in both the aggregate supply of labor willing to work for the current money wage and the aggregate demand for it at that wage. Okay. So one thing to clear up, What is this term wage goods? Well, you may have missed it. He defined it earlier. A wage good is a commodity for sale in the marketplace that people who earn wages care about. Okay, so just think of it as groceries and gasoline and rents for apartments, stuff like that. Okay, so it's like a basket of goods in the CPI. Something like that. So it's the thing that people who earn wages care about the price of. So it's not the price of a tractor or the price of a piece of farmland. It's the price of stuff that people who earn wages go buy at the store. Okay, so how somebody said in the comments, so wage goods equal consumer goods. Yeah, I mean, that's one way of thinking about it, but it's, yeah, but it could also be like a house. And so some people might say it's a consumer good. So I'm just keep in mind that it's not just like little knickknacks. It's things that people who earn wages buy. Okay. And yeah, the money wage equals the nominal wage. Some people are asking in the comments. Yeah. So Keynes distinguishes between money wages and real wages. So money wage is what we might call nominal wages. It means the actual number of dollar bills or euros or whatever you're getting paid. Real wage means the number of dollar bills adjusted for the price of wage goods. So it's the purchasing power of your paycheck. And so the classical economists usually thought that workers ultimately care about their real wages. They don't really care so much about the actual absolute number of money units they get per week. They care about what can I buy with this. In particular, how many wage goods can I get with this thing? Okay, so let's look at this statement again. So men are involuntarily unemployed if a small rise in the price of wage goods relative to the money wage. So think about what that means. A small rise in the price of wage goods relative to the money wage, what that means is people's real wages are going down. But they're going down not because the money wage fell. The money wage stays the same, but the price of wage goods goes up a little bit. So Keynes is saying, if the price of goods that workers care about, consumer goods, things in the CPI, if that goes up a little bit and money wages don't move, and yet the aggregate supply of labor goes up and employers' demand for it goes up, well then originally we must have had involuntary unemployment. And so that's a weird way of thinking about it, but that is true. If you think about it. So because that's saying, if this is true, this thing that I've just put in quotation marks here, if that statement is true, it can't, that second postulate could not have been true. Because the second postulate says right now in equilibrium, the wage is just balancing the disutility of labor. So if the second postulate is true, and then I tell you the price of wage goods goes up a little bit, but money wages stay the same. Well, if the second postulate were true originally, now that the price of wage goods goes up a little bit, that should mean you get a drop in the aggregate supply of labor willing to work at that wage, because now real wages have gone down. So if before the quantity of labor was such that on the margin, the last person working was just getting balanced with the disutility of labor, and the guy who's just unemployed and is on the fence thinking about, do I want to work or not? He says, nah, the disutility of me working is a little bit higher than the utility I'd get from the money wage given the prices of wage goods. That, if that's true, the second postulate's true, well now if I disturb that by making the prices of wage goods go up a little bit and I'm not increasing workers' nominal paychecks, well that should now shift the balance to make more workers drop out voluntarily from the workforce and say, nah, I'm not working now, because before I was just barely getting paid enough to make it worth my while. Now, even though my paycheck is the same, I can buy less stuff at the store, so no, my leisure is worth more. I'm not working as much. All right, so that's what would happen if you had an equilibrium originally in the labor market were clearing. But Keynes is saying, if that doesn't happen, if the prices of goods go up, wages stay the same in money terms, and all of a sudden you see more workers, you see employers willing to hire more workers, and you see more labor forthcoming to be employed, well then clearly that second postulate wasn't holding originally. Right? So that's what he's saying. Okay. We've got about 10 minutes left, and I'll turn over your questions. So effective demand, he has a whole chapter on this stuff, and let's just run through this. Okay, so again, this is all coming from chapter 3. Let me again say here, this is difficult reading. A lot of people have complained about Keynes, saying he's a hard writer, and that is true. All right, so I don't think he's as hard as some people make him out to be, but I struggled with these readings, and it took me, I told you guys, several hours just to read 50 pages, even though I've read it before, because I'd read a paragraph and I'd have to stop and go read it again to say, wait a minute, what did he just say? Because it's partly that he's, you know, his British sentence formation, but also he just comes at stuff from a weird angle. And so sometimes it's hard to say, oh, he's just saying something obvious, but he's saying it a different way. Or sometimes he's saying something you think is crazy, and you have to read it a few times to say, is he really saying that crazy thing? Yeah, he is. Okay, so that's why it's difficult. So don't get discouraged. And again, this is the hardest part of the course. In particular, the stuff in Chapter 3, he starts talking about Z's and D's and mathematical functions. We are going to get into the graphical expositions of Keynesianism, but we're not going to do it here because that's the whole point. Guys like John Hicks and Paul Samuelson with their ISLM curves and all that stuff, they try to boil down all of the convoluted verbiage in the general theory into the essence of it. They say, this is what Keynes is saying. And let's just boil it down into a few simple graphs. And so I'm not going to try to do that here. We'll wait till the section in the course where we talk about that aspect of it, and we'll go over some of that stuff. Okay. But for our purposes now, how do we parse Chapter 3? Well, he gives two definitions. So he says, what's the aggregate supply price? He said, it's the total expected proceeds just sufficient to induce entrepreneurs to hire a certain amount of workers. And I put the word price there in quotation marks because price suggests that it's a unit thing, but it's not. The aggregate supply price for Keynes in this Chapter 3 is like total revenue. So it's not saying what is the price per unit of output. It is saying the total take. So how many total dollars or how many total euros or yen is the economy, are the entrepreneurs collectively in the area going to take in from employing a certain amount of workers, and then what's the lowest that number could be in order to make them willing to hire that many workers? Okay, so these things are all predicated on or defined in reference to a certain volume of employment. So again, the aggregate supply price is saying the total expected proceeds that entrepreneurs would need to expect they would receive from hiring a bunch of workers, having them produce something and then selling it, you know, how much with the bare minimum we could get total from doing that to make it worth our while to hire this many workers. And so that's some number in money terms. Aggregate demand is the total expected proceeds entrepreneurs will receive from selling that output produced by a certain amount of workers. All right, so they're similar. The aggregate supply price is saying what's the lowest that number could be to make you willing as the entrepreneur to hire that many workers. The aggregate demand is saying, in fact, how much total proceeds are you going to receive? Okay, so what's effective demand then? Effective demand is the value of those proceeds or that level of the proceeds corresponding to the amount of employment where aggregate supply equals aggregate demand. So it's just saying, so we can, and Keynes, he doesn't draw graphs, but you can tell he's thinking graphically, saying that the aggregate supply and aggregate demand lines are upward sloping. All right, so it might be weird to you there that you're thinking, well, no, one should be downward sloping than that. They're both upward sloping with N, the volume of employment, number of workers, N on the x-axis, and money on the y-axis. And they're both increasing. Right. So, again, let's flip back a slide here. Aggregate supply price, the total expected proceeds just sufficient to induce entrepreneurs to hire a certain amount of workers, that's increasing in N. So to get them to hire 1 million workers, they'd have to expect whatever. $100 million in revenue. To get them to hire 2 million workers, they need to expect $180 million in revenue. To get them to hire 3 million workers, they need to expect that. So you see, That's why this the word price there is confusing, and so I put it in quotation marks, because it's not a unit thing, it's the total. So if to get the whole all the entrepreneurs in the whole country to be willing to hire so many workers, how much do they need to expect? So that's why that's upward sloping. To get them to be willing to hire more workers, they would need to expect to get, or they would need to get more total proceeds from selling the output that those workers would make. Okay. And then aggregate demand is just saying, in fact, what would their expectations be? So where those two things balance is the level of effective demand. All right, and Keynes gives an equilibration argument as to if the supply price is higher than the aggregate supply is higher than the aggregate demand, then employment what? Shrinks. And if it's the other way around, if aggregate demand is higher than aggregate supply, then employment expands. Okay, so effective demand is the amount of demand at which the employers are getting proceeds just sufficient to induce them to hire that many workers, and the amount of output that's being produced by those workers is enough to that everybody is spending that much money on. So I realized that was a convoluted way of saying that. Okay? So, you know, once you get over the strange definitions and so forth, or the unorthodox definitions, you might say, well, wait a minute, isn't that just sort of a clunky way of talking about the labor market that any economist would talk about? What the heck is Keynes, what's the big deal? He's just saying, yeah, there's different equilibrating processes, and in equilibrium, the employers don't want to hire more workers, and the customers are spending a certain amount of money on the products, and that's the income that the entrepreneurs are getting, and they're not earning net profits, and that's why they're in equilibrium. They're not expanding, they're not contracting. What's the big deal? The big deal is Keynes' twist is that his notion of effective demand, that might happen, so you might have a stable equilibrium even though you've got large-scale involuntary unemployment. So that's the thing. And that's one of, some people would say that is the contribution of Keynes. Other people would say there's other stuff going on too. It's too simplistic just to talk about this. But for sure, that's one of the central planks of the Keynesian system. That's one of the things he did in the general theory, is Keynes showed that, or argued, if you thought he was right, that a free market economy left to its own devices could get stuck in equilibrium with large-scale involuntary unemployment, and there would be no reason for it to get out of that rut anytime soon. So remember, that is in sharp contrast to what Keynes called the classicals and what we would just call free market economists would have said. According to free market economists, no. If there's large-scale involuntary unemployment, the economy is not in equilibrium. The labor market is not clearing. It's not stable. In particular, the wage rate is way above where it should be. And so once we get rid of whatever the constraint is that must be coming from outside the market, once we get rid of that, the wage rate will drop. The quantity demands of labor will go up, and that will take care of the unemployment problem. Okay, so Keynes was saying, that's one way of thinking about it, is Keynes came up with a structure, a way of modeling the economy such that it could get stuck where the equilibrium level of output was well below the full employment level. Or to put it in other words, the economy could be in equilibrium, you have effective demand, aggregate supply equals aggregate demand, but guess what? The amount of proceeds that the entrepreneurs are getting at that level of effective demand is not enough to make them willing to hire all the workers who want to work at that wage rate. So there's involuntary unemployment, possibly on a very large scale, but yet you've got equilibrium, that aggregate supply equals aggregate demand. So make sure you guys realize that the term effective demand, you might think that, oh, effective demand means what does demand need to be in order to hire everybody, to provide full employment, so it's effective. And that if if we don't have effective demand, then we've got unemployment, so Keynes thinks the government needs to spend. No, that's not what it means. Effective demand is saying where aggregate supply equals aggregate demand, and that can be at a point of less than full employment. So one way of putting it is effective demand is not the same thing as full employment demand. Make sure you get that distinction down. Okay, so big picture summary here. We're almost done with the slideshow. The classical economists, relying on Say's law, thought that there was never a problem getting people to buy all the output that the economy was capable of producing. It was producing stuff that was hard, according to Say. That was the tricky part. We have scarce resources, and you know there's only so much labor to go around. Labor has disutility. Getting things organized and getting people to produce stuff, that's the tricky part and the hard part. But once the stuff is made, it's no problem to consume it. Right, so that's where Say was coming from, and that was the mindset of a lot of his disciples or people coming after him. Whereas Keynes was saying, no, in the real world, the economy really can get stuck below the full output level because people aren't spending enough. So the problem really is on the demand side. It's not that there's some technological problem or that there's some institutional barrier, you know, bad policies that are preventing resources from going to the right spot. It's simply that the way the economy works, if we more accurately model it, if we use a general theory and not the very narrow special case tools of the classicals, if we adopt a general theory, we can see that, no, it's possible in general that a market economy can get stuck because the forces that determine the variables in the system, you can be in a stable equilibrium where there's not enough spending to induce entrepreneurs to hire everybody who wants to work at the prevailing wage rate. So you have involuntary unemployment, and there's no reason for it to go away anytime soon. There's not automatic market forces that kick in to quickly get rid of that unemployment, which is what the classicals would have thought. Okay, so one subtlety here, just be careful. When I'm saying people aren't spending enough, I don't just mean people going to the mall and buying toys or going and buying more DVDs or something. So it's not just consumption spending. Here, I mean just spending in general. That could include investment spending. So this is an open point of controversy. Some Keynesians get upset when critics of Keynes try to paint him as an apostle of consumption. And they're going to say, no, in the Keynesian system, his problem was not that, oh, sometimes people don't consume enough. He was saying the problem is people aren't spending enough, but that could include investment spending. All right, so that's a debatable issue as to when Keynes was diagnosing what happens with an economy, is he saying, oh, people weren't consuming enough, or is it just he's saying people aren't spending enough? But for sure, the system itself is, at this level of generality, it could be consumption or investment spending. Okay, I think this is the last slide. Yes, this is the last slide. Okay, so in Chapter 3, and then also the parts that I talked about, the excerpts I gave you from, what was it, Chapter 12, which is a very broad survey here. So Keynes did think that consumption spending was proportional to income, and that's where that whole propensity to consume comes into play. And that's partly what's going on, that Keynes was saying if sort of an intuitive way to see, how could the economy be stuck? You've got people who want to work, and you've got productive resources lying around, so why wouldn't the employers just hire those people? Now there's more demand in the system, so why wouldn't the workers then with the paychecks go to the store and buy the stuff that they're making? So, it seems odd that how can it be that the system gets out of whack where you've got perfectly productive people just sitting around idle and we're at less than full output? Why doesn't the market just allow those people to go work and then pay them their marginal product? It doesn't make any sense. You know, if it were a barter system, it would be fine. So why is it that with the money system, things get messed up? And Keynes is saying because if you hire those workers, now, yeah, it's true, the total income in the economy goes up because now those workers are getting paid more, but they're not going to turn right around and spend every last penny on output. And so from the employer's point of view, they're losing out. They're paying, you know, their payroll goes up, they're having to pay more out, but their revenues are not rising proportionately or by the same amount. And so they're actually on net losing money, so that's why they don't do it. And so the issue is to how can you move the economy from under less than full employment to full employment? Well, it's got to be the case that the increment in national income that's generated by hiring all those workers now gets spent somehow to buy all that additional output that's been made. Otherwise, it's not going to be individually rational for the employers to do it. And so it can't all be made up by consumption spending because people don't spend their entire paychecks on consumption. So that means investment has to fill the gap. But now the problem is, and this is where the stuff from Chapter 12 comes into play, Keynes does not think that businesses, in terms of their investment spending, obey a nice little rational framework where, oh, the interest rate adjusts to, you know, clear the loanable funds market, and so therefore, if consumption spending doesn't fill the gap, well, then the interest rate will just keep falling until investment spending fills it, and then you get, you know, total spending equals what it needs to be to justify that level of output. Keynes doesn't think that happens because he thinks that the investment, especially in the modern market economy with a systematic stock market and so forth, he thinks that that's like a casino. So let me just very briefly here talk about two of his things there. So the famous one is the animal spirits, and I had that quoted in the assigned reading that you guys had. So just the people are animated. They're not making rational long-term, oh, these are my probabilities of this is, you know, how much revenue I'm going to get and so forth. At this interest rate, I'm going to discount by a certain amount, so here's the present net value of the project, and this is how much I'll invest. Oh, and the lower interest rate, Keynes is saying, no, people are guided more by emotion and animal spirits, and just if there's a boom, people are real happy, and they go, you know, bid stuff, and it's because he's saying it's not so much that they're irrational, it's just we really have no clue what the state of the economy is going to be 10 years from now. So if you're an investor trying to do that, who knows? So it's not so much that Keynes is saying people are stupid. He's just saying it's so crazy what he calls dealing with the dark forces of time and ignorance. That, you know, to try to assume things will just rationally balance out because prices will adjust is crazy. Then the last thing I'll talk about here is his famous analogy of the beauty contest. So here Keynes is saying the thing that's weird about the stock market is that, you know, even, let me back up. So even though we have these dark forces of time and ignorance, and it's really hard for us to say what is this company going to be worth 10 years from now, so how much should I pay for a share of stock, Keynes is saying you might think that there would be sort of like a wisdom of crowds effect, that, yeah, any individual making forecasts might be wrong, but if we get millions of people participating in the organized stock exchange, surely on average the successful stock speculators will make more money and will tend to weed out the bad ones, and surely that on average the crowd's going to be right. That any individual might be wrong, but surely we get millions of people making their independent assessments of this company, its stock price is going to be fairly accurate. And Keynes is saying, no, that's not right. For one thing, you're not trying to, as someone who's going to buy stock, if you think, let's say the stock right now, I'm making up these numbers, if they're not the numbers in this book. If the stock right now is selling for 20, and you think 5 years from now it's going to be selling for 100, you might think, oh, you should buy it now and bid up the price. He says, no, what if you also think that because of crowd psychology or whatever, next week that stock is going to sell for 15. Well, then you shouldn't buy it right now. You should short it because you think it's going to go down. And so Keynes is trying to show you there that it's the logic of the stock market and what he calls the fetish for liquidity actually doesn't reward long-term investors. The reward is trying to just get the jump on everybody else and make your money quick. And so he got this famous beauty contest analogy. He said the situation with the stock market, he said it's like newspaper, and I don't know if this is true. I guess it must have been true that newspapers would show a bunch of pictures of women in a beauty contest, and then there'd be judges. And so how do you win the contest? He said, well, it's not, there's no objective way of saying who's more beautiful or not. So he said the way that you would win is like the people who picked the pictures that the crowd thought were the most beautiful. So when people were playing this game, Cain said the point was not for each individual to pick the top five best looking women or whatever. He said rather the right thing to do would be to say, which of these women do I think most people are going to say are the best looking, and that's what I'm going to write down as my personal picks, because then if I'm writing my forecast, the people running the contest are going to look at my picks and say, yep, this guy picked the women that most people pick. It's sort of like that show Family Feud, if you guys know that one. In Family Feud, the goal is not for you to pick what you think the best answer is to the question. You have to think of a survey of 100 American households, what were the answers to this question, and then you're trying to guess which one did most people say. Okay, so that's a similar thing. So in the stock market then, the point is, to make money in the stock market, Keynes is saying, it's not that you want to go out and buy stock in the companies that you think are going to be the most profitable over the next 10 years. No, what you want to do is buy stock in the companies that you think other people are going to believe are the most profitable in 10 years, because that's the stocks they're going to buy. And so if you buy those stocks, their price is going to go up when those other people jump in. So it really doesn't have anything to do with intrinsically which are the better stocks. It has to do with what does the crowd think the better stock is. And then people have taken this, and it leads to an infinite regress, because then if everyone's doing that, you take it one level. So then you realize it's not that I'm picking the stocks that I think everyone else on a fundamental analysis wants, because everyone else is doing the same thing I'm doing. So really what I want to do is I want to guess which stocks do other people guess the crowd will like. And you can just keep doing that infinitely. All right, so it gets kind of philosophical. Okay, so why don't we stop there, and I'll open up your questions now. We'll go to 35 after, because I went a bit long as I usually do on these things. So again, while I'm pulling up the thing on Moodle, let me just stress, for those of you who want to get really technical with this stuff and you want to go over specific passages from the general theory and get into the math and everything, that's fine, we can do that. I think that's a bit too much for me to do in the formal lectures here. I'm certainly not going to quiz people on that. So if you do want to do that, let's do it in the questions for the professor sections. Okay, so just pulling up the course here, and now we're on week 2. Okay, Pear says, it seems to me that Keynes' theory is based upon the ignorance of workers, that they would willingly accept a reduction in the real standard of living as long as their nominal wage income is not going down. Is it possible that this illusion of keeping up when real wages are going down is getting weaker today with instant communication? Yeah, so again, this is a subtle point. It's a great question, Pear. Yes, for sure. Keynes does say in certain passages of the general theory, part of which was in chapter 2 and we went over today, he does say that workers suffer from money illusion, that workers are not indifferent between having their real wage go down from A, keeping the same money wages but the prices of stuff in general go up, or B, prices in general stay the same but your paycheck goes down in money terms. Keynes is saying workers do not view those two things equivalently, even if the numbers were such that in real terms they were the same. Keynes says workers much prefer not having nominal wage reductions. If you're going to reduce their real wages, better to do it with prices going up. So now, when you say stupid, or whatever word you use there, Keynes is not saying that workers are dumb for doing that. He actually, because this ties into his more fundamental point. He was saying in there that even though a lot of economists who might begrudgingly admit that this is true would say, oh yeah, but the workers are silly, then they're being irrational. And Keynes is saying, no, the workers are actually smarter than the classical economists for these reasons. So then he goes through and explains, and that leads into the stuff that I talked about, where Keynes thinks it's not obvious to me that if workers all did take a big wage cut in terms of money wages, that they would actually lower their real wages and therefore would promote fuller employment. He thinks that that might just cancel out. So he's got a I didn't cover this explicitly, but he does have a passage in there, and I think it's chapter 2, where he says something kind of funny about why the workers are smarter than the economists, and the workers are, there's a justifiable reason for them being, for unions, for example, violently opposing any drop in money wages, but not opposing a general rise in the prices of goods and services. So, just Per, just to know, so show you that you're in good company, though, Mises made exactly that point in the theory of money and credit in the stuff he did in the 50s, like the supplement to it that came out in later versions. Mises talks about Keynes, and Mises says, just like what you're saying here, something like, so this is Mises talking about Keynes, saying in the Keynesian system, Keynes thought that the solution to the problem of unemployment was to use inflation as a means of sort of tricking the worker into accepting a wage cut that the unions would not accept if it were done in money terms. And then Mises says, what Keynes didn't realize is even as the general theory was coming out, workers had already adapted to this, and unions were already building in cost of living adjustments into their contracts. So not even to say getting weaker today, Mises says in the 50s that even in the 30s, the late 30s, unions already were onto this ploy and, you know, were smart enough to know that if the prices of goods and services were going up, that their workers needed to get more money from the employer. The unions were not just fighting over money wages, ignorant of the fact that really what their workers cared about was purchasing power. Okay, Jorge says, why is the general theory aimed at classical price theory and not at business cycle theory? Was Austrian business cycle theory unknown in the UK at the time when the book was first published? Okay, so one thing is, this is actually what I've been struggling with, is what to assign you guys for week 3, because there is a whole section. Let me see what it is. So in book 6, chapter 22 is Notes on the Trade Cycle. And that comes after a chapter that's called The Theory of Prices. So you're that's a very perceptive question you're asking. Is you're right, Keynes is focusing more on the classical treatment of prices and in particular wage rates, and not a business cycle theory per se, but the two do go hand in hand. And so he does, if you're curious, you can see that Keynes does talk in chapter 22 about business cycle theory. To answer your other question, Hayek was at the LSE, I don't know, does anybody know off the top of their head when Hayek was at the LSE? That sounds right to me. Yeah, 1931. So Keynes makes reference to Hayek throughout the general theory, especially, the parts about the marginal efficiency of capital and stuff like that. So Keynes does know Austrian business cycle theory, or at least knows of it. I don't know how well he knew it. But anyway, that's what I'd answer. But just think about, if Keynes is right, what you're classifying as his focus on price theory, Keynes would say that is the solution, though, to the business cycle. All right, and the stuff that Keynes is talking about in the chapters on investment also has a lot to do with the business cycle. Okay. Let me just see what do we got on deck here. Okay, I'm not going to be able to get through all these questions. I'll just do one more, and then I'll answer these in the forum itself. So Andrew Robbins says, what does Keynes mean by full employment exactly? Is there a particular reason why it should be the goal of an economy to aim for full employment? What about the people who value leisure more? Okay, so what Keynes means by full employment is a situation where there's no involuntary unemployment. I mean, that might not be the way he defines it, but that's true. So the economy is at full employment when the only people who aren't working are doing so because they're valuing their leisure more, or they're looking for work, but they're searching for a particular type of job. It's, you know, they could go work over here at that wage rate and they could get hired if they wanted to, but they choose not to because they're trying to get a job like in some new city where they're moving, or they're switching careers or that kind of thing, or, you know, they just got laid off yesterday because their factory closed, and so now they're just seeing what their options are, that kind of thing. That stuff's okay, but what's not okay is when you've got large scale people sitting around without a job. They're perfectly happy to go work at the local factory for what the guy's paying those workers, and the boss agrees that their skills are interchangeable with the skills of the people who he's paying right now. So if that's going on, then the economy's not at full employment. Okay, so why don't I stop there? Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. And like I say, I will, by this weekend, by the office hours, I'll catch up with the questions you posted there. Okay, so I will see you guys next week. I'll send out an email tomorrow giving you all the details you need about the specific readings for next week. If you want to start tonight, though, for sure it's going to be the last chapter, and I just need to decide if I'm going to make anything else going along with that to be optional.